Welcome back, everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA-FM, the home of the Big 4-0 Birthday Bash, taking place Saturday, January 28th. More information at WEAA.org. And we are about to have a conversation about police reform in Baltimore. There's a lot going on. There's signing, if one does get signed, if it gets signed, people hope it gets signed, the consent decree by the mayor with the DOJ before the orange man becomes president. And I'm sorry, but I had to say it. So which would kill all the consent decrees that exist. I mean, any future consent decrees, I would say. But so that's A. B, there's negotiations with the police union now, which raises questions of the law officers of a Bill of Rights and the debate that may be taking place in Annapolis. There are numerous questions around these issues, and we are joined with our guest here to talk about what that reform might mean. Doug Ward's with us. He's director of the Johns Hopkins University's Division of Public Safety Leadership. Good to have you back here with us again, Doug.
Great to be here.
Retired police major Neil Franklin, former Baltimore and Maryland State Police officer and executive director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Good to have you.
Always a pleasure,
Always
Mark.
Good to see you. Good to see you, man.
Yep.
Ray Kelly's here, former president of No Boundaries Coalition. Still with them, still organizing. Good to have you in the studio.
Always a pleasure.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org by email. You can text us at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook page, but do join us at 410-319-8888. So there's a lot going on. So if you were to, what would you say were the chances this is going to get signed? And if signed, what will it mean, this consent decree with the Baltimore City Police? Doug?
Well, I think it will be signed here shortly. But even if it's not, I don't think it's going to make much difference. So if you look at it this way, the report and the issues that are outlined in the report, and the majority of people in the city of Baltimore, I think, would agree that something needs to be changed and positive progress needs to be made. So regardless of what happens in D.C., the people of Baltimore are going to continue to demand that reform takes place. And I think there's a lot of good people within the Baltimore Police Department and city government who agree. So I think that it marches on regardless of whether it's signed now or not.
Huh, interesting.
I think it will be signed. The only fear that I have, even with the, as Doug said, even with the effort at the community level, at the city level and state level, you know, to make the changes that need to be made, sometimes, and I'm speaking about Baltimore, what I know of Baltimore,
right.
Sometimes when there's no hammer behind an effort, it starts out well for a while. But then it seems to die off, especially if we start to experience some progress and then people get comfortable and we revert back to old habits.
So I'm going to come back to the two kind of contradictory points you just heard here and what that might mean. Ray Kelly?
So for the No Boundaries Coalition and our residents, we kind of see it as necessary for a completion of a process. So we engaged a lot of residents that suffered the ills from the findings report and who were feeling disinvested in this from the system and disenfranchised. So the idea was to actually re-engage these people in the process, and if it weren't to come after the results of the election, I mean, that's detrimental to a community that we quadrupled voter turnout in Sandtown on the premise that change is coming, where it would be disheartening to a whole community that this didn't pan out, where people are actually buying into a new process and hoping for change.
So let's pick up for a moment here. I'm interested in the different things that the three of you just said here. You were saying in some – maybe I misunderstood you, Doug. But you were saying, you said in essence, you don't think that it mattered whether a consent decree was signed or that it won't make a difference in the long run. What are you saying? I'm not sure.
Well, what I'm saying is I think it'd be better if it gets signed, because I agree with Neil that the having that hammer in the background does help make things move. However, I don't think that people weren't trying to move in this direction before – this report came out. I mean, I know that there have been a lot of attempts to try and make things better within the police department for a long time and headed in the right direction, right? And I think those are fueled by both you know, leaders who recognize things need to be improved, and the political situation where, you know, you hear from people what needs to change, right? So I think that the politics in Baltimore are such that that issues around this report, whether the report is the guiding force or not, are not going to go away. People have known they needed to be addressed. It will be harder to address them without an agreement signed, yes. But I wouldn't also assume that just because we're having a change in administration that all the laws that back up how this stuff happens are going to change. I mean, there's a lot of pieces that have to change to really make a huge difference in how these things are handled across the country. So I'm not that worried that that changes won't continue based on the need to change them. There are a lot of smart people in the city who know these things have to change, and that's going to continue. It's going to be a little more difficult unless you have the federal government behind it, but it's still going to have to happen.
Mm-hmm. I have two quick points. Number one, timelines are good. They help keep people on track in getting things done. So I'll leave that where it is. But most important in my mind is the political environment. I have a lot of faith in Kathy Pugh as the leader of the city now, but she's only guaranteed 4 years right now, and we don't know what will happen 4 years from now. This process is going to take a lot longer than 4 years to get to where we need to be. It's a continued process from this point forward. And we saw what just happened in our national election just a couple of months ago. So politically, things can change on a dime, which means direction can change on a dime if we do not have a consent decree.
I mean, and Ray?
Well, I just feel as a legislative advocate where we know or we feel that unless they are mandated to change certain things, our history says that they won't. We've been in this fight many a year in Annapolis. And I understand Doug's point that people will still fight, but we've been fighting for decades, and those changes haven't come. So like Neil says, you got to have that push, those timelines, that mandate from the federal government that this has to happen to help our reform efforts. And we don't think that this is the solve-all, but for us, that push for policy changes and systemic changes, it's a very valuable tool.
Well, I mean, one of the things that people, and welcome to the program, good to have you with us as well. Joining us here in the studio as well is William Miller, Senior Community Organizer with Communities United. Good to have you in the studio, William. And let me get you closer to that mic, or get the mic closer to you so we can hear. There you go.
Okay.
Welcome. So one of the things that we talked about this program, folks, do join us at 410-319-8888, just a few weeks ago, which was a group of people that was really an interesting conversation, who thought it didn't make any difference whether a consent decree was signed or not. That the real issue was civilian control of police. The real issue was civilians sitting on the review boards and the trial boards. And that without that, there is
it's all the above.
It won't really make the changes we need. I mean, yeah. So what about that argument?
So for me, having civilians on the review boards and on the trial boards, it's a must. Because if you don't have it, then actually what happens is everything still stays the same. You know, the benefits you get from being a police and having other officers supervise you, you're still going to receive those same benefits. You're not going to be looked at like you should be looked at without some outsider being there to view it.
And what do you think? What difference do you think that would make?
Well, I think
Let's say, for argument's sake, you were sitting on a trial or review board. What difference would that make? Do you think?
I think it would make a lot of difference because it would be a different point of view. You know, you have people there that are not police officers and that have nothing to do with the police department but have everything to do with the community.
So what about that argument, gentlemen? Anybody else want to jump in? Ray Kelly?
The civilians on the trial boards is important in transparency.
Which is different than review boards. Let me just say this. We're talking about
right.
The review boards are, people are calling for a civilian review board with teeth where cases are reviewed to see if you need to go to prosecution or exoneration with a police officer.
Right.
Trial boards are, if an officer internally, if I'm correct about this, Doug Ward, and Neil, that a trial board is if an officer is accused of a wrongdoing and has to be disciplined by the police department, that happens internally in the police department that civilians are not part of, and people are saying civilians should be part of that as well, which is a much more intense thing, actually, in many ways, and personal thing than and legal aspect of it than a review board.
Right.
Just want to be clear. So mm-hmm. You were saying then we'll turn to the two foreign officers right. after you.
So really this the whole movement is based on the lack of trust between residents and police officers. So we, moving forward, if there is going to be any type of reconciliation, there has to be transparency. And as well as the police are sworn to protect and serve us, we should be part of that process when they don't do that or they're derelict in their duties. And that's creating a form of accountability to us when we have voting members on the trial boards.
So how do you...
Well, I think it's important to have public legitimacy in our government organizations. And one of the ways to do that is to be more transparent about how things happen and to have citizens involved. So I have not a problem with citizens being involved in that process. I will say, however, though, that a number of the studies that looked at this kind of thing have shown that the citizens who turn out to be on these boards tend to side with the way it's been done in the past. So, I mean, there are so many intricacies and issues, but I think it's important to have that external view. But if you look at the outcomes, it really doesn't change much.
That's interesting. That is interesting. I'd like to see those. I haven't seen those studies. I'm looking forward to reading those.
Yeah. So, and what Doug's saying, really what's important here is transparency, which does a lot for the relationship between the police and community by being able to have civilians on these boards. And I say both trial boards and review boards, they need to be on, especially when we're talking about a complaint that involves a complaint between a citizen and a police officer. That's where it's really important. And one other board that we haven't mentioned, which I think we need, is a police governance board.
What does that mean?
Where the philosophy of the, it's a board where instead of having the mayor who hires and fires the police chief, sets the direction, philosophy, controls the budget, and so on, you have a board of community members, business leaders, faith leaders, assembled to govern the police department, even down to budget and so on, but not getting into operational issues. That's up to the police chief. And the reason I say this is because we follow in this country, we say in law enforcement, we follow the 9 basic policing principles, the Peelian policing principles. And principle number 2 speaks to this, that we not only exist as a police department, but the work we do within the community is by the permission of the citizens. So look up Peelian principles, look up that number 2, and you'll see that it speaks to not just our existence in law enforcement within the community, but everything that we do within that community should have public approval.
So let me go to the phones here and see what our listeners are thinking, because there's a lot of issues here. And there's also the question that we have to explore over whether Baltimore City should have control over its police department. What would that mean? That takes the state legislature and the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights. And people have been battling around reforming and changing that for a long time. And that's tied in, I think, to the police negotiations going on now, with police union negotiations going on with the city. So let's come to that after this call. 410-319-8888. As we look at the future of policing in our city on the eve of what appears to be the mayor's finishing negotiations and the signing of the consent decree with the Department of Justice, that if not signed before this week and doesn't get to the desk of a federal judge, means that the incoming administration could just say, we don't have to worry about the consent decree. But if it is then, if it's signed by the city and the DOJ and goes before a federal judge who implements it and say, yes, this will be policy, and hires a monitor, there's nothing then that the new Department of Justice can do to stop it because it's a matter of law and is pushed ahead. So that is what is at stake here, along with the other things we've been talking about. With our 4 guests at 410-319-8888. And Hank, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, young man. How are you?
Very well, Hank. Good to hear you. How are you?
I am blessed. Okay, here's my thing. Like the young man was just saying, and I was going to state this fact, right? Okay, so even if we do have a civilian on there, which, I mean, it's nice to have it signed because we need a civilian on there, right? Who picks the civilian? Because most likely they're going to place a civilian in there who's going to coincide with what they want, right? So how do you pro-check the pro-check?
Say the last sentence again. How the folks what?
Okay. 9 times out of 10, if there is a civilian there, right?
Right.
They're going to be the one who selects who the civilian is. right? Or how does a civilian that watches them get selected?
That's a really critical question, right? Right, right. Yeah. And there've been arguments back and forth. Go ahead, Hank.
Yeah, because see, they're most likely going to pick someone who's going to coincide with seeing things the way that they do. They're most likely going to pick some retired police officer who's a civilian who's no longer, you know, active in this. Now he sees things the way that he saw when he was an officer.
So that has. You know, Hank, I appreciate that one because I think that's been a sticking point in these negotiations. The police commissioner wants to be the one who approves and brings them in. Does the mayor do it? The mayor is saying maybe the mayor should be able to do it. Should it be appointed by the city council? Is it a non-political process where someone's elected? I mean, how do you appoint somebody to a review board or a trial board, and how does that get decided?
Well, that would definitely be a process that would have to be negotiated in a way. But you would need some sort of checks and balances there. You would need a process, just like we do in our courts when we pick our juries with voir dire. It can be done. It just hasn't really been decided in detail yet.
Well, how's it done elsewhere?
I think I'd be great on one of those boards as a civilian.
Well, as a former police officer, as a civilian, I think you would be good on those boards.
Well, it could be done a lot of different ways from appointing, electing, and all that kind of stuff. But to me, the big issue here is trust. And we can have all the commissions and board and oversight and exposure to civilian participation. But until that trust is built every day on the street between one patrol officer and one citizen, this is what we're really trying to get is trust, right? Trust and transparency. We need to start, I think, not only with conversations around what do we do at the top and the commissions and the reviews, but what are we going to do on the street to change that? Because if you can change it on the street, you're not going to have these trust issues and who's going to be appointed and we don't like this about that. You know, those go away when people in the community and the officers on the street mutually have a trust in what they do. And so that's the key. That's the real key to the answer to this. It's not some board or commission. They're just going to be another argument about who's on the board and that kind of thing.
Well,
so go ahead, please. No,
I'm just thinking about piggybacking off what you William said Miller. Concerning trust. You know, if the police department would stop, like, going into the neighborhoods with military tactics and just abusing people, then, yeah, you could build some trust. But as long as those practices continue, there's not going to be any trust. So, you know, you need to look at rechaining the police and how they react to the inner city, especially the inner city people. Because right now, the inner city is under siege. You know, people are scared. I mean, young people expect to be locked up. Young people expect to be harassed by the police now. And that's a shame, because it shouldn't be like that. So we have to start there. You're exactly right.
I think we're all right. I think we're all right. I think it's a combination of all the above. What Doug said, it's important that we really focus on those efforts in the street, continue to do that with our police officers and the citizens. It's also civilians being on review boards. It's also a police governance board and working to get to each and every one of these places. They all work together and check each other. So I think they're all important for us to strive for.
So we have the phones here unless you want to jump in, Ray.
Yep.
410-319-8888. Join us for this conversation about the future of the police. This is going to be one of the most important issues facing this new administration. All of us looking for, are there alternative public safety strategies we can talk about? 410-319-8888. Where does the money come from? Leo, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning, Mark Stein.
Good morning, Leo Burrows.
And good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Well,
morning.
Of course, I'm concerned about the financial implications, and I wonder what you guys think. The former mayor, who I thought was not accountable and not responsible for overseeing the correct duties of the police department, namely Stephanie Rawlins Blake, had stated at one point she thought we should give the police department $30 million for implementation of a consent decree. Of course, I disagree with that because the police department is already overfunded, in my judgment, and of course, needless to say, the overtime is unlimited. Why do we need to give the police additional monies to do the right thing? And of course, where do you guys weigh in on the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights, which quite frankly should be unconstitutional or declared such, and abolished or repealed in our state? Are we going to set up a commission on reparations to repair the damages done to citizens in the last 10, 15, 20 years? How are we going to compensate people who've been victimized by police brutality?
So the money question is a huge question in this consent decree. Many people are already arguing in the city that too much money is spent on the police department, not enough on other services in the city.
That is right.
And some people are arguing that maybe the police department budget should be cut and maybe find alternative ways of doing public safety that also builds community. I mean, and some people say, well, that's pie in the sky, feel-good stuff. It doesn't work. So, I mean, what about this issue of money, how much we spend, the extra money the consent decree will take? And we don't know what that amount will be and what happens then to services in the city. How do you wrestle with that?
So,
Ray, go ahead.
I just feel like we're talking about civil and human rights, and how can we put a price on that? If this consent decree is going to remedy a decades-long practice of violating rights in our community, which is the hope for the consent decree, that price shouldn't be an object. And I agree with the caller that we spend too much, but we're already spending over $400 million a year on policing. When we have these reforms in place, you'll kind of eliminate some of these tactics and initiatives that aren't fruitful and they don't really pan out within the police department. So it's going to be a checks and balances where these reforms are long overdue. So whatever the cost, like the brother just said, we're getting people beat over the heads, and they expect it and they accept it. And it's been that way my whole life, where that's the way it is in our community, and that's what has to change. We talk about the trust, and we have to recognize that trust is earned. We've heard a million times that this is going to change, that is going to change, and until we actually see it changing, we're not going to buy into it.
One of the real positive things about having a consent decree is it's an opportunity to make changes you couldn't otherwise easily make, right? One of the things, it's down to the budget. If you properly look at this and you prioritize strategically, what are we trying to accomplish and what's the best way to get there, you're going to be able to stop doing some things that maybe the police department has been tasked with over the years that they, you know, maybe it's not getting the best results. Maybe it's not the best place to spend your time and effort and money and the authority of the state. And you stop doing those and you point to the decree as the reason why you're stopping them, because you get a lot of people want you to do what they want you to do, right? And then you look at, how can we cobble together some federal grant monies? How can we get some help from the state? Nobody's going to like to hear it. We may have to raise taxes. There may be a compilation of 8, 10, 15 ways to get different funding in and stop doing things that are not as effective or don't get you to where you need to be as much, right? So that can save money. And I'm sure there, you know, every budget, I mean, I ran a budget for many years in the state police, and there's always ways to save money, and it's just hard to do it politically because everything you're doing, somebody wants you to do it. This report helps you point to something and say, look, we'd love to keep doing X, Y, and Z, but we just can't afford to because the others are more important.
So
we just most of what needs to happen is changing procedures, changing policy, using best practices, just changing the way we go about doing business in the police department. And we know what those changes are. We just had 100 police officers sent back into patrol from some of these other specialized units. And that doesn't cost any money. You know, put them on foot patrol. And to train them.
But they're not necessarily on foot patrol. They're just back in the community.
Well, hopefully they're going on foot patrol. You know, I know it's cold outside, but, you know, other people walking around outside, too. To train people, you've got people who already have the knowledge that needs to be shared with the police officers, and having those training and creating that training environment that does the things that need to be done. De-escalation. Doug and I were talking about de-escalation before we came on the show and the training that needs to be done there. You know, how do you develop relationships? And a lot of it is really to stop some of the bad behavior and hold people accountable. A lot of that doesn't cost money. You know, we should stay away from hiring firms, a lot of crazy technology, which we really don't need. You know, this is about being present, being on the ground, in the community, in the neighborhood to make the changes that need to be made.
So, because money does come down to the bottom line here in many ways. If you think about, I mean, let's just, for just a second there, because I want to come up, raise some things that may some people may think are a bit off the wall in a moment, but I do want to talk about them seriously. But I think that, I mean, you have a school system in Baltimore City that now has a $129 million deficit. 10% of their budget is gone. You've got a consent decree that's calling for $30 million. You've got a state budget that is maybe $400 million short on revenues for the coming year, $1 billion over the next several years unless something changes. So the money becomes a question. I mean, where does that money come from? And how do you do it? And is it does a dissent decree then force the city to pay money inside the police department in ways it doesn't want to? Or in ways that it's tied to, I should say, where its hands are tied, can they be creative in how that's done?
They can.
You know, or are its hands tied in terms of what and how it has to be spent? If they agree to certain things inside the consent decree, we don't know what they've agreed to. That would then take money away from things like rec centers, school systems, safe streets, healthcare. I mean, you know, those are real issues here, it seems to me.
Yeah,
it's not as simple as saying sign the consent decree and then we're done.
Money is an issue, but let's look at the money that we waste, the money that the police department and every other agency in the state of Maryland and in Baltimore City waste, you know? So we need to look at, you know, cutting costs in a lot of areas, but hopefully it doesn't affect the schools, you know? But, yeah, money is an issue. But we, you know, it's the whole thing. You know, you're talking about money. I think changes is worth paying for. And I also think that in order to change, you first have to start, you know, doing the right things opposed to the same old practices. And that's what has – your mind has to change. The thought has to change.
I mean, right now we see a police department. Do you want to say something? Okay, you're about to say something. The right now you have a police department that has, in some ways, after the rebellion and Freddie Gray, literally said that they disengaged, pulled back. Street officers saying we've pulled back. And the murder rate, over 300 people killed, 319 people killed in the city of Baltimore. It took us almost 22 minutes to read every name and their age on the show last week. To just read the names of all the people killed in the city. So, and that's one of the biggest things you have to put your hands around in Baltimore City, I think, first. The loss of life and the terror on the streets that exists. Does the consent decree get to that? I mean, does it change the way police officers police? How they ensure the safety of citizens without abusing citizens? That, to me, seems to be the bottom line here. I mean, how do you get there?
I mean, it's important. But it's no one silver bullet in all of this. We've got to find the resources to put in the community to deal with our kids. We've got to prop up families and households. We've got to have employment for people. You know, we've got to have, as mentioned before, the rec centers. And we've
parenting, education, prenatal care. Let's start with health. Let's start with housing. Let's start with jobs. Let's, you know, start with a good education. I mean, it's going to take 20 years and a lot of money in a lot of other places to fix this. We as a society don't want to fix it that way, though. We've pretty much, I mean, it's not that we don't know what works. It's not that we don't know how to fix it. It's we don't want to spend the money to do it. But that's the real fix, you know. That's hard. You know, say, well, how do you cure poverty? Well, you know, there are 100 answers to what you have to do, right? But, you know, so we have to fix the police department, but we also have to fix those other things. And it's going to take a lot more resources to do all that than we have.
Well, don't forget ending the war on drugs. It's policy has a lot to do with this, too. And again, there wouldn't have been a Freddie Gray. There wouldn't have been a whole lot of what we've seen reported in the DOJ investigation. We've got to change the policies. And I know this is down the road in a big picture, but, you know, we're not going to have sustained success if we continue along this path that we have for the past five decades in this country where the criminal justice system, on the backs of the war on drugs, has decimated the black family in this country. There's no question about that. And until we end that, we're going to have these struggles year after year after year after year, not just in Baltimore, but in Chicago, L.A., Philadelphia, Atlanta, every major metropolitan area across this country.
It's a public health issue is what it is.
Right. Absolutely.
I think we need to circle back almost to what Mark actually was speaking on, which is the violence. And we have to look at this whole process, once again, as the consent decree being a tool. We right now don't have a strong police presence. Like you said, there was a disengagement, a pullback, so to speak. And I speak from Western District, where we see these high murder rates, but actually in 2014, just a couple of years ago, we were celebrating the lowest homicide rate in Western District just 2 years ago, which was 21. And then the year of the unrest, it escalated to 61, I believe, and people aren't really remembering the best practices from just a couple of years ago.
So, what were the best practices a couple of years ago?
Well, just it was engagement. It was a unified effort between the community organizations and the Western District Police. There was a strong visibility effort to kind of deter the open air trade. And when we had that pullback from the police department, we have an influx of opportunistic drug activity, and now it's out of control, where now there is no entity. It's not really safe.
So, William, I'm not sure what part of town you live in, but well, so how did you see that? How do you see it?
Well, for me, he's exactly right. A lot of times, though, if we had more police on the street, I mean, engaging with the community, I'm talking about officers that walk the beat like they did when I was young, then I think the relationship would be a lot better too. And then those open air drug markets, they couldn't exist because the police is walking the beat all the time. A lot of things that happen now is happening because of the lack of policing, not because they're doing a fabulous job. I'm telling you, man, if you had police on the beat throughout this city would be much more different. When I was growing up, the police knew everybody in my block, knew your name, your mother, and everything. And that's where we have to get to. We have to get back there.
So, you know, we're going to take a news break here in about 2 minutes and come back. And so I'm curious, I'd like to hear from our listeners what they think it would take to make real reform. How should that take place? What's your idea of public safety in this city? We're in the middle of negotiations with the police union, which has a lot to do with this. Right now, the city's negotiations with them. The state legislature is coming up with the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. Will once again be a discussion. Whether that's going to go anywhere in this session or not is a huge question. Probably not. Do you add money to the police department? Some people think that's an anathema. Do you take money away from the police department and put it somewhere else as a way to kind of begin community healing and putting police on the street? What does that mean to you? 410-319-8888 or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that as for the rest of this conversation when we come back from this news break. But, I mean, I think that maybe in some ways we have to start talking about things that we have never talked about before when it comes to the future of policing and public safety. Maybe it's a totally different model that we have to think about than the one that we – with consent decree notwithstanding.
Well, I agree. It has to be a completely different model. And, again, having the police do what the police should do and having our healthcare practitioners do what healthcare practitioners do. You know, we still haven't had a true concerted effort in this city to deal with our people out there who are suffering from addiction and have a host of other challenges, health-related, education related and job training related. And again, many of these people are carrying the stigma of a criminal conviction, drug conviction on their backs. And until we deal with that and put those people in a better place, you know, we can siphon a lot of the customers from the drug trade. which would then reduce the number of people out there on the corners, you know, selling the stuff. But we have yet to have a concerted effort in this city or any other major city across this country like they do in some of our European countries.
We have to go to break here, I think, but I had to take a quick news break and come right back. But has it been – when was the last time there was a thorough audit of the police department?
I have no idea.
Has there been one?
I don't think we keep a commissioner long enough.
I can't remember any.
Yeah, so that might start there to find out how the money's being spent to start with. So we can have a short break and come back with our four guests and you, 410-319-8888, two former police officers, Doug Ward and Neil Franklin, two community activists, William Miller and Ray Kelly, and you at 410-319-8888. Right after the news, we shall return. Don't go away. Mark Steiner right here on the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA, home of the big 4-0 birthday bash taking place Saturday, January 28th. More info at WEAA.org. Today, as a matter of fact, is the 40th anniversary of WEAA. Today is the 40th anniversary of WEAA. So happy birthday, WEAA. I was just a child myself then. Just right. So anyway, so we are here with Doug Ward, director of the Johns Hopkins University Division of Public Safety Leadership. Retired Police Major Neil Franklin, who served both in the Baltimore and Maryland State Police, who is now Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. William Miller Sr. is a community organizer with Communities United. And Ray Kelly is former president of the No Boundaries Coalition that he's still active in. And you all at 410-319-8888. So we have Anthony, Louise, and Chris. We're going to come to your calls here. But I want, first of all, you to take part in what happened when we were off mic. Some interesting things always happen when the mics are down. And we were talking about, question is, has anyone done an audit of the city police? When the last time was it done? And I think, John, we were saying that we can't remember when it was done. The question is, who would do it? Is it a state agency? Is it a city agency? Right. If it's still a state agency, then why doesn't the comptroller go do an audit? Let the state pay for it, since it's not a city agency officially. It's complex, Doug.
Well, in state government, the legislature has the legislative auditors. And usually every 2 years they come around and do a fiscal audit, and then they do performance audits from time to time as well. So that is seen as an independent, obviously the legislative arm, looking at the executive organizations and making sure that all the systems are working properly and there's no waste, fraud, and abuse and that kind of thing.
But we also talked about the fact that if we just put 100 police officers on the street, there are almost 3,000 police officers in our department. And you two officers, former officers, raised a point, and you gentlemen chimed in, which is that if you're wearing a badge and a gun, why are you sitting behind a desk?
Well, sure. So in the state government, we went through about a 10-year process of what we call civilianization. So in many cases, there were police officers with badges and guns doing administrative duties, from buying cars to flying helicopters. And we went through a process where we looked at each and every position in the entire organization and had to justify, why does this position need to have a badge and a gun? And if they don't, why are we paying this premium salary when we could be making a lower level civilian position and getting that work done? Or what is the work that doesn't have to be done by us? What are we doing that, you know, we did it 20 years ago, but nobody's asked for a report from it for the last 15 years, and can we stop doing? And you go through a whole process, and you have to start at each position, justify why is it need to be what it is, and can it be something else, or can we stop doing it? And you go through that process, and you've come to find, oh wow, there's some savings that can be had here.
Mm-hmm. It's the same with those who have been injured, either on or off the job, who we placed into administrative positions where they're still carrying a badge maybe not a gun. And when we realize that they've reached maximum benefit medically and they're not going to return back to full duty, then there's the process of retiring them on a medical retirement. And in many cases, what we did back in the early 2000s, we were working to get those people since he already knew the administrative job, just transition him over into a civilian position, free up the sworn PIN number, and then we could hire another police officer. And I know now, I think we're somewhere around maybe a little over 2,500 police officers, and back then we had about 2,900, if not more. So that's another thing that needs to be looked at, too. How many people are not going to who are medically disabled, not going to return back to full duty and retire them on a medical and then rehire them in that civilian position some kind of way.
So, unless, gentlemen, you want to make a comment, we'll jump into the phones here. 410-319-8888. Anthony, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Mark. Thank you so much.
Good morning.
Good morning. And good morning to your guests. I think one of your guests said this, and I have to agree. A lot of this that we have on the streets today starts at home. I grew up on the corner of Frederick Avenue and Franklin Town Road. And I have to tell you, my neighborhood was not the most desirable place to be, as I remembered as a kid. But my parents raised me to understand one thing. You have respect for yourself and respect for people on the street. What's missing from society today is that foundation. And then on the second page, I remember seeing police officers at the West Side Shopping Center on Frederick Avenue. That is missing from our community, like the caller said before. Yeah. We need to get to look at the salaries, if you ask me, that are way above pay for an officer at a high rank, okay, and do something with that money other than giving it away to a high-ranking official that we could use in the community somehow for more police officers on the street, whatever you want to say. But the crime's not going to go away until we get back to what your panelist said, more officers on the street and parents being parents in their home and in the community. Thank you for my call.
Thank you.
Well, when we have children raising children, it's very many people who have kids don't have the abilities and the knowledge of how to raise a kid or so on. There's a lot of history behind this. And the criminal justice system, again, in the war on drugs, has a lot to do with the decimation of the black family in this city over the past 4 to 5 decades. And Mark, you and I have talked about that in the past with the loss of jobs going overseas and then beefing up the war on drugs from the 1970s. We arrested a lot of black men, heads of households in the city, and left these families virtually defenseless in a number of different ways. Mothers having to go out, get multiple jobs, kids left to the streets, raised by the streets. That's a whole nother story and issue, but it is relevant to this conversation. How do we get back to solidifying the family structures, the households in this city and other cities? And it's going to take resources to make that happen. And first and foremost, it's going to take a different approach and, you know, to where we're not arresting and stigmatizing so many people with criminal arrest and conviction so that they can get jobs, so that they can become gainfully employed and take care of their family needs.
You know, I'd just like to say that it's very possible to do this, but you first need to train those community people, you know, and teach them how to teach their children, because you made a good point. Kids bringing up kids, don't spell nothing but disaster. So we need agencies, we need organizations to have input into that and be able to teach those people that too. And when you come to the war on drugs, it was never a war on drugs.
War on people.
It was a war on us, our communities, and our neighborhoods. Because no black man in America is a drug kingpin. We just don't have the resources. Be logical. You know, so the war on drugs really needs to end, because it's for better. It's crap. We know it. So mass incarceration has to stop, because it's crippling the African-American community. Once you take the head of the household out, the family crumbles. The woman needs the man there, too. The children needs the father there, too. But I think one out of every three of us African-American males have a record.
And that, and we're talking about black men who live in working class communities.
Yeah.
That's even, right. So it's even more people per when you think about right. it that
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
Just real quick. 1 out of 54 white children have a parent or parents in prison. 1 out of 9 is the number for black kids. Just okay. to put it in context.
You would say that's what? Great.
I just, there's a lot of wisdom in that. And I look to a lot of economics literature. And if you look at this from an economic standpoint, it becomes pretty clear. When you criminalize, let's say the opioid problem, that now people are finally realizing we have a huge opioid problem in the United States. And it's way past inner cities. It's everywhere, right? It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Now, why do we have the gang problem and the violence problem? It's because there's a supply and demand issue, right? There's a huge demand. Because why? Because the federal government decided to crack down on doctors prescribing and overprescribing opioids. When you crack down on that, what happens? People find a different way to go. And now we have a heroin problem. Well, big surprise. No, not at all. It's supply and demand. It's an economics issue. Mm. Where do drug dealers flourish? Where there's an easier way for them to get away with it. That's why the cities are burdened with this. But the people who are buying these are not just from the city. There aren't enough people in the city to use all the drugs that flow through here. It's coming from the suburbs and everywhere else in the country. Mm-hmm. It's flowing through here, right? But the people who are living here in this are being doubly affected in a negative way, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the answers to the gang and the violence and the murders is less use of drugs, which is treatment, which is less criminalization and more public health model. Fix it that way, and it's going to take a long time.
So let me come back to Ray here, but let me get to the phones quickly before we run out of time at 410-319-8888. Chris, you're on the air.
Hello, Mark. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
To your guest. I've spoken to you about this a couple of times before, and a couple of your guests have referenced it, that it is the felony drug record that is locking a lot of people into a cycle of so-called criminality because there's an alternative economy in the street. And so until we start to really discuss how we're going to deal with the record, the criminal record of that felony, in the past 2 years now, we've had a bill in the House and the Senate for nonviolent felony expungement. The effect of that, remember, we're talking about mass incarceration, which was fueled by a war on drugs. Well, the result will be felony drug records. Mm-hmm. And this, again, this is now allowing legal discrimination. We've legislated away discrimination of all kinds of categories except felony. You can't discriminate because of age, sex, weight, religion, all of that stuff. But if there's a felony, you can legally discriminate. And that is what is driving what we're seeing to a degree. There are other factors and other issues, but that is a large cause of it. I'm personally dealing with groups of people who are legally marginalized because of their felony drug record. Until we seriously discuss, we looked at all of these issues of expungement as related to marijuana.
Right, right.
That's fine. It should be. But what that was for was to facilitate a marijuana industry coming to Maryland. We still, that will not free the minds of people who spend time in Cumberland, MCIJ, or any other prison facility in the state of Maryland.
Chris,
people are there for felony.
Chris, I appreciate the call. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, especially if we're talking about what might be easier on the legislature, if the argument was felony drug expungements.
Right, right.
I mean, they're going to have a hard time doing a felony violent for violent crimes.
Right.
But for drug crimes, felony expungement could make some political sense.
Right. So that's another piece of the many things that we're hearing during this discussion that we need to focus on again. So it's not just one or two or three things. We really have to have a comprehensive plan involving all of these things that are going to affect change.
Let me try to get on the call here to come back to our final thoughts from our guests. Louise, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, hi.
Good morning.
I wanted to talk about what the DOJ report said. The DOJ report said that the police face complex and economic challenges rooted in poverty, racial segregation, ineffective education, and employment opportunities. That's where the money should be spent. That's our safety issue. And what does the former mayor and the former city council do? They spend money on Port Covington. In the face of this DOJ report, that's reprehensible. And as far as I'm concerned, if the police are going to pull back because they're asked not to abuse then they should, you should just get rid of the police department, get rid of the state control, and, you know, let the sheriff's department take over. They don't need to be there. They're not going to do their job. And so that's what I have to say.
Louisa, I'm glad you called. Let's get some final thoughts here. I think that, this is, and we're going to come back to the question here on the show, is of how do you have an alternative public safety strategy that's not always about the police, which means it might mean taking money from the police budget and putting it elsewhere.
Yeah.
But let's have some final thoughts on what you just heard. Very quickly, we only have like a couple minutes left.
Yeah, so as far as what she said about the police pulling back, you know, pulling back and not doing anything is atrocious. All we want you to do is to do your job the right way, you know, to do it the way you're trained, to look at people and their actions, not what they're wearing, and just treat people with respect. And you can still do your job, be effective, and treat people with respect. And that's all what we're asking. Go out there and do your job.
William, final thought.
Well, I'd just like to say that I have faith in the fact that the community will work with the police department to re-engage and build a stronger community. But we have to first change the mindset, not only of the police, but of the community also. And as far as the police pulling back, I'm in agreement with you. They need to do their job. That's what they get paid for, to do their job, not to stand there and do nothing, you know?
Ray Kelly.
I think we should all just recognize where we are in time, and this is a generational moment where for years and years we fought for it, we talked about it, and this is our time to unify and change. So we need to take this tool that we get and use it in every way possible to actually build better community police relations, and in turn, we'll build better community.
This has been a great discussion. I look forward to it. Oh, no, Doug, your final thoughts. I'm sorry.
I was going to say hallelujah.
Amen.
I am optimistic, okay? I know we have to focus on the bad things that are going on and things like that, but I'm optimistic. I know a good deal of the people in the leadership positions in the Baltimore Police Department, and they are really good people. I mean, you know, and I think there are a lot of really good officers out there, and I think they want to do what's right. I think what the police department really needs to do is give them the permission to do that, right? So, because these few bad apples and some of the organizational culture that hangs on from the past that stops the good activities can go away. And I think we have leaders in place that are trying to fix that. And I think we should support them in any way we can to do that. And I think the changes will come. Now, we're not going to get all the changes overnight. You can't flip a switch on a big organization like this and just turn everything off and turn it back on. But we're all headed in the right direction. I think people living in this city want it to happen. I think most of the police officers want positive change to happen. And we just need consistent, beyond the four-year election cycle, leaders that are going to be there and keep making these changes. And it's going to take about 10 years or so. And it would be better, but we have to be patient. We have to look at all the things we talked about, and we have to just keep at it, keep fighting the fight.
Doug Ward is director of the Johns Hopkins University's Division of Public Safety Leadership. Neil Franklin is retired major, city and state police, executive director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. William Miller Sr., community organizer with Communities United. Ray Kelly, former president of the No Boundaries Coalition, where he's still an active organizer. Thank the four of you so much for this conversation. And we'll keep it up, and we'll have many more conversations about the police in the coming months. And it's always great to have these gentlemen on the air with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Take a short break, and when we come back, we are going to take a look at the Affordable Care Act and what it would mean if it's scuttled.